How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Richard Zwicky with High on Healthy. Joining us today, we have Dr. Stephanie Mazur, a licensed psychologist and founder of MindWise, Inc., which is based near Palm Beach in Florida. And with her, we'll explore some insights into relational dynamics, clinical integration, and how therapy can create lasting transformation for individuals and, most importantly, for couples. Welcome aboard the show, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me.
So, Stephanie, you're psychodynamically trained, but integrative in practice. And explain what psychodynamically trained means, because it's not the common stream that people speak about.
So we're looking at our past dynamics, anything that really shaped our worldview, how we enter the world, how the world responds to us. So relationships, experiences, for some people, trauma, for a lot of people, what we call little t trauma. So things that might not seem earth shattering, but have imprinted on us, and they impact how we relate to the world and relate to each other and function in relationships.
You know, that brings up a really important point right off the bat, because a lot of people talk about, you know, and we'll jump around a bit for topics, but people talk about when they're dealing with ACEs or when they're dealing with attachment style issues later in life, it's often points to a trauma that happened. Of course, with ACEs, it's when childhood experiences, but sometimes people think it was a minor thing that happened. And yet later in life, that minor thing, that scar, has festered into something big. How do you look at it, and how do you explain to people that even though they may think it was a small event, here's why it's a root issue and how it built up into something bigger for them?
So how I conceptualize past experiences is how we sort of create our own understanding of ourselves and the world, and also how our nervous system experienced these events and sort of remembers the events. So we're kind of wired to have the same type of physiological experience, which can impact our thinking and our feeling. So kind of two different ways of conceptualizing depending on the individual and what's being presented. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And of course, I understand you work extensively with neurodiverse clients, and in particular with late diagnosed ADHD and autism, which of course also affects how we perceive. Our perception of the world is always unique, right? I'm the only normal person in the universe. You're the only normal person in your universe. And as we get through neurodivergence, everybody is, of course, divergent from us. But we don't really think of the world in those terms on a day-to-day basis. How does therapeutic practices, when you're dealing with late diagnosed ADHD and autism, change?
I really work with each person individually. So it's hard for me to take a big net and capture a generalized idea of that. Sure. Can you ask me something a little bit more specific?
Well, so as people come to recognize their, let's say, ADHD.
Okay.
We've gone our whole lives. We've learned adaptation skills. We've learned behavioral traits. And we've learned to adapt, but in doing so, we've also not processed some of the traumas that other people would just have managed through authentically through a standardized process because of the way we see the world. How do we have to approach that differently from a therapeutic practice? And how can we help our family members who are struggling with this because it's hard to see it in ourselves and to relate to the world around us until it's conceptualized and put into terms for ourselves properly?
So I'm going to do my best to answer. So we have social constructs, right? And right. So social constructs make up how we view people and how people are sort of taught how to navigate the world and what's right. normal and what's abnormal. And so some of those social constructs can be stifling, if you will. And bumping up against those social construct frameworks that each individual might not fit in can be a very invalidating experience, a very difficult experience. And so in therapy, we want to validate those experiences that may have not been understood or responded with in a thoughtful and mindful way, because we're looking at frameworks and constructs that maybe didn't take into consideration the unique characteristics of the individual, of the person, and what that experience was like.
Yeah, and you know, on social constructs, that's an area which is extremely inflamed with today's political discourse. What areas of mental health do you see as being too politicized, and where there's too much political discourse without enough facts?
I would say that my personal bias is diagnosis and insurance companies.
Right.
So I am a private pay practice because I don't believe in diagnosing somebody after the first session so that it can be reimbursed by insurance.
Right.
I need to have a thorough understanding of who I'm working with. I can have a working diagnosis and a diagnosis that I'm looking to rule out, but you have to have a diagnosis for the insurance companies. And the diagnosis is really to inform a treatment plan. And on any given day, somebody might meet criteria for a diagnosis. And so really understanding the socio-political economic context of diagnoses in working with clients. And that's really relevant to the work that I do with clients. There are some diagnoses that a client clearly meets criteria for that's going to help inform the treatment plan. Sometimes by naming the diagnosis, it's, you know, relieving for the client. Okay, this is what I'm struggling with. It has a name. Right. And in other cases, it doesn't work that way. Does right. that make sense?
No, it does. Because, I mean, one of the challenges, of course, you can only capture so much data in a 1-hour session.
Sure.
And one of the areas that is a big black hole is data with regards to capturing, understanding, and longitudinal studies in a lot of this, that you can even begin to go down the right path in one session, because people present themselves differently from one session to the next, depending on their mood, depending on the experiences of the day, mm-hmm. what's on their mind, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the insurance companies, of course, their mandate is they're paid to provide the service to the organization or the family or whoever hired them. And they're looking to reimburse back to the practitioner, but they need everybody to fit in a box, and they don't. But it goes beyond that, doesn't it? Not just the immediacy of diagnosis, but also the conflict between scientific consensus and political debate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The utility of a diagnosis is to inform your treatment plan, the work that you're actually doing with the client.
And, you know, on that, is it a constant battle for you, or is it something which that's why you're in the private payer system and foregoing the other?
It's something I'm very mindful of.
Right.
I'm not constrained by right. by the framework because I don't take insurance.
Right.
But the influence of insurance is definitely felt in how we look at things. It really is.
It is. It's there's a lot of money there, and there's a lot of that drives a lot of discourse.
Yeah.
Right. So flipping over a little bit, it's, you know, one of the things when people come in and are trying to deal with things later in life, a lot of times they've built up their patterns. They've, you know, they've manage the wounds that they've and they have, but they haven't really addressed the root issue. And then they present themselves with, you know, we refer often back to the attachment styles as issues. And avoidance is a reflection of the fact that there's some trauma or some abuse that hasn't been properly addressed. And it's causing them to, it's causing them that when they meet triggers, which may be genuine love from somebody else, they recoil. How do you tie these together with regards to seeking help to recover from early childhood trauma? And how do you help couples surface and work through the anxiety that ends up driving the distance and blame that results in emotional shutdown?
So a couple things. When we talk about sort of the root issue, I'm looking at sort of a landscape, if you will.
Right.
And so what that landscape looks like and how and the experiences that have been built upon that landscape. What you were referring to sounds like a disorganized attachment style or a more avoidant attachment style. So those are two different attachment styles. One is rooted in trauma, the disorganized attachment, where it's like this push-pull. I really want intimacy, but I'm really fearful. And that's more related to trauma. When we talk about more of an insecure, avoidant attachment style, that's more related to having the experience of what we call our primary caregivers, not being responsive to our needs. And so we take on this hyper independence. And underneath that is a fear of dependency, because if I depend on you, my needs aren't going to get met. And so we don't want to get close to people and experience that pain. And so the anecdote to that is what we call corrective emotional experiences. Any experience in relationship, whether with a therapist, a partner, a friend, where underneath that dynamic, there's a foundation of security, consistency, and trust.
How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com. Tired of social media censorship? Frustrated by restrictions on TV, billboards, and traditional radio? CannabisRadio.com is the only platform where you can connect directly with over 1 million dedicated listeners without the limitations. Advertise your product freely to high-value, educated decision makers. Launch your unrestricted campaign today. Email Brasco, B-R-A-S-C-O, at CannabisRadio.com.
And that's a challenge for a lot of people because they're afraid of the relationship in the first place, isn't it? But they need the relationship to heal, which creates a point of friction.
Yeah, and that's very relevant to how some people conceptualize anxiety in relationships. It's this battle between sense of self, sense of belonging, need to be independent, need for connection. And so that's where a lot of tension and anxiety manifests.
Right. And you refer to it as a landscape, which is, you know, it's true. There's no one way it expresses itself, nor one root issue. It's always a blend, and we always have to be mindful of that. But for the entrenched relationship and relational cycles where, you know, the people go through that cycle, repeating it over and over, you know, what's the most effective way to break those patterns of conflict and avoidance? And then, of course, when one's avoidant, you make the other partner anxious and anxiety, because no matter how secure you are, you want to help your partner, and that creates anxiety.
Mm-hmm. So I think I'm hearing a few different questions.
Oh, there's always many.
So let me take it piece by piece. Any new experience where you're able to try out, where you feel safe enough to try out a different behavior, and right. you get a reassuring response, is going to build on a new type of experience and emotional experience, understanding, right. and maybe almost allowing yourself to trust that maybe things can be different. And then if we repeat these patterns and we get yep. the same response, because perhaps we happen to be relating to the same types of people right. or we behave impulsively based on blueprints from years past, that sort of reinforces the belief that this can't change and this is how I'm going to keep myself safe. This is how I've always kept myself safe. This is more of an unconscious process.
Of course it is.
Yeah, so we're not really actually saying that to ourselves, but we're going to repeat those maladaptive behaviors that kept us safe when we were little that are not helping us in our adult relationships, but with the same goal. I want to feel safe.
Yeah, and feeling safe is key in any relationship. It's a fundamental tenet Absolutely. And premise of why we're with somebody, right? Yeah. So when we don't feel safe, it's going to come out.
Oh, yeah.
And in that circumstance, the partner to the individual mm-hmm. wonders what they're doing wrong that's driving away their partner. How can they make them feel safe? Because they can see the good. That push-pull pattern is damaging, but creates anxiety where none existed before. So how do you break it? How do you help couples break it?
I think first it's important to identify what's going on. Mm-hmm. What are these attachment blueprints that yep. you're bringing into your relationships? When are your attachment systems getting activated? Meaning, when are you feeling threatened? And I really start with, when do you feel it in your body?
Right.
That is our first signal, our nervous system.
Right.
When we feel unsafe. So when do you feel it? When in that conversation or during the day, when? Let's slow it down and let's look at our bodies first, our nervous systems. And then we can get into more of what's going on emotionally. What you were describing was a little bit of the work I do with emotion-focused therapy when we're talking about blame and withdrawal and some of these safety behaviors or behaviors that aren't in an effort to help us feel safe.
Right.
Because maybe we're feeling devalued or rejected or disrespected. And the first signal goes to our nervous system. I don't feel safe. I don't feel valued. I don't feel protected. I don't feel prioritized. I don't feel considered, and on and on and on. So does that answer your question?
It does. And it actually opens up another area, which is many mental health professionals seek out therapy for themselves often, and I know that that's part of your practice. They're dealing with a lot of trauma in other people. They're dealing with trying to help people make sense of it, trying to accustom it, but it also must strike up their own wounds and background issues they've struggled mm-hmm. with themselves for many years. Why do therapists sometimes require even more support than the clients they serve?
Well, so I graduated in 2009, and part of the requirement in all of my schooling, which was a very long, long time,
right.
We had to go through our own processes.
Yeah.
And healing and growth is a lifelong process. So if you are not mindful and you're not taking care of yourself, then you might get triggered, burnt out, need more support than you might otherwise if this isn't something that you're practicing daily, self-reflecting, asking for support, practicing mindfulness and grounding, allowing your body to reset, examining what's happening in your relationships. Crucial.
Right. It is crucial. And it also takes, there's an interesting part of the adaptive mindset for people who are going through that also, in that because the more knowledgeable you become, you also become more knowledgeable about ways to defend and or avoid the trauma or the problem that's actually there, to speak around it. And that's got to be a big challenge for you as a therapist, because the more sophisticated the client is that comes in, the more layers of the onion you actually have to peel back.
Well, one thing that really surprises me is that a lot of programs do not require therapists to go through their own therapeutic process. So that is something that really surprises me. Whether I don't find any cases to be, or people that I work with to be, any more complex or sophisticated than the next. I'm really just looking at authenticity,
right,
connection, vulnerability, and providing a safe, consistent space to explore.
And, you know, that opens up, you mentioned about, you know, the different groups. How do you see psychedelics as a tool for integration and healing?
I don't know anything about psychedelics to be able to comment, so I wouldn't even be able to help with that question. Okay. Out of my scope.
No, that's fine. You know, it's interesting. So many therapists are turning to them for particular aspects, and for some it's wonderful, and for others they don't work with it, and that's fine.
I personally, I'm a very open-minded person. It's out of my scope. I don't have any experience.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And when you're treating with, you know, when you're treating clinicians who are themselves dealing with patients, how do you navigate the balance between professional insight and personal vulnerability? Because that does become more and more of a challenge the deeper you get.
Are you talking about my own personal? So if it's clinically relevant, I do self-disclose.
Right.
And I don't have any problem self-disclosing if it's clinically relevant.
Okay. And how do you think the profession can better normalize the idea that mental health professionals, you know, because we look at mental health professionals, the general population, and thinks they're the ones who have it all together. They've figured it out. They've done the work. They know, you know, they have the magical answers we can turn to. How do we destigmatize the fact that they also need help on an ongoing basis?
Yeah. So there is no magic. I hear that a lot. There is no magic. It is important for mental health providers to be doing the work.
Right.
We are human, just like everybody else. We are no better off or worse off than anybody else. This is the human condition. We're going through this journey together. But I would hope that anybody who is taking lives in their own hands is doing their own personal work. And I truly believe that healing and growth is a lifelong process.
I agree. It absolutely isn't. You know, going back to something we touched on early on, as we were chatting, and it just, you know, popped into my head with regards to it, and the disinformation that's out there, and misinformation or lack and things, and neurodivergence and autism. There's quite a debate about, of course, vaccines, autism. It's a flashpoint in public discourse. Despite the scientific consensus that vaccines do not cause autism, it remains a very political debate. So, Stephanie, what, you know, one aspect of your practice deals with high-performance athletes, leadership, people in leadership positions and the like, who, of course, we all face the same challenges as everybody else. We just happen to have found the area where our potential aligns with our capabilities, and we've really pushed and worked hard at it. But we deal with the additional pressure and review and perspective of why are we not better than we are in other things? Because when we perform incredibly well in one area, we expect we can perform in every area. How do you help people reconcile that challenge?
So it sounds like you're talking a little bit about perfectionism and self-concept, how we see ourselves. I would say that with a lot of gifts, we have to understand that we might have extraordinary strengths in one area, but we might have some weaknesses in another, and that's okay. That's what makes us individuals and humans. We can't be perfect at everything. And it's really important to know your strengths and to know your weaknesses and to not internalize beliefs about yourself based on one area that you might not be as successful or strong as in another. And that's why as a leader, it's great to be able to delegate, right?
Oh, it is. It's incredible. It's why it's a key skill to learn. But it's also why a lot of people deal with imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And that brings challenges through your personal and professional life as well, because you every day, you're not just proving yourself to yourself. You also feel you have to prove it to everyone around you. How does that change the dynamics for your relationships as a whole?
Me personally?
No, imposter syndrome. I don't know if you have imposter syndrome or not. I don't have that as my professional skill.
I think that most people have either had that experience at one point, right? Everybody's had the experience of having that first day on the job or that first day at an elevated position that you're ready for, but you don't realize it. So I think a lot of people have had that experience. I think that it takes experience, and I think embracing those thoughts and feelings and insecurities that might come up. I'm not sure if I know how to do this. I'm not sure because you're not sure. And why should you be sure if it's the first day, but you're ready and you have the capability. And it's healthy to be conservative about your understanding of what your success might look like on, let's say, your first day or your first year. We don't want to come in with grandiosity. We don't want to come in overestimating ourselves to defend against that vulnerable feeling of, I'm not sure. You kind of have to prove it to yourself and show yourself you're ready. You have the abilities. Trust the process.
Yeah, it's actually quite a fascinating piece because I've built multiple companies, and every time I think, how am I doing this? You know, and how am I able to do this? And I have lots of people depending on me because I don't do my job well, you know,
and that's normal.
It's normal. And the most empowering statement is, I don't know.
Yes.
Right. And how do you, you know, but people struggle with that for years because they're afraid to show, people mask, people show the face they think the world expects them to show. And that's very different from the reality of who they are behind the mask. Mm-hmm. And as they're struggling and trying to deal with it, that creates relationship challenges at work and at home because they don't turn one or the other off. So it's hard to get to know the individual and they lose themselves. How do you help people walk back from that?
I think that's where the work is. In learning how to be authentic and learn how to connect and be okay being vulnerable.
And on being vulnerable, that's probably one of the most important lessons we can learn in anything, because that's when we actually accept our ability and our ability to learn and to contribute to others. Mm-hmm. Because we share who we truly are. Mm-hmm. So Stephanie, tell us quickly, you know, about the practice of MindWise, and for people who want to learn more about how to reach you and to get in contact, how can they do so?
So MindWise Inc. is based in the heart of Wellington, Florida. You can find me at drstephaniemazur.com. Stephanie is spelled with an F, and I specialize in working with athletes, high-performing achievers, and couples.
Wonderful. So thanks for joining us today on High and Healthy, Stephanie.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. I'm Richard Zwicky, and we'll be back again with you soon.
How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com.